when your baby leaves you all alone, and nobody calls you on the phone, don't you feel like a crime? Don't you feel like a crime? For here I am, honey, come on, you're kind of me. When you're all alone in your lonely room, and there's nothing but the smell of her perfume, don't you feel like a crime? I feel like I cry. Come on, come on, cry to me. Oh, nothing can be sadder than a glass of wine alone. Loneliness, loneliness, such a waste of time. Oh, yeah. Oh, come on, take my hand, baby, won't you walk with me? Oh, oh yeah, when you're waiting for a voice to come in the night, but there's no one, don't you feel like I'm crying?
Hello, my guys, gals, and non-binary pals. We had a little bit of a boo-boo where I thought the mic was on and I was literally speaking to you guys, but it actually wasn't on this whole time. So that's a little bit awkward, but we live and we learn. So you are listening to CKUT, and this is Voices of Montreal Panacea with me, Michelle. And today is the third part of our neurodevelopmental disorders discussion. So we spent the last 2 months talking about ADHD, but today we're going to learn about another neurodevelopmental disorder, autism spectrum disorder, and we're also going to use that as a segue to talk about implicit bias. I'm not sure if we'll have as much time as I planned for because we did lose 15 minutes, but that's okay. Life happens. But you just listened to Cry to Me by Solomon Burke, and that's one of my favorite songs right now. So neurodevelopmental disorders are a group of conditions characterized by an early onset, and they're believed to be the result of disruptions to normal brain development. And so they're characterized by developmental deficits in a variety of domains, like social, cognitive, motor, or language deficits that have their onset during childhood and then persist into adulthood. And so neurodevelopmental disorders, or NDDs as I'm going to call them because that's a little bit easier for me, it's an umbrella term that encompasses a variety of impairments in your brain function or the central nervous system. And so ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder, as along with Fragile X syndrome, tic disorder, specific learning disorders like dyslexia, and autism spectrum disorder. And so ASD, or autism spectrum disorder, is diagnosed on the basis of difficulties with social communication and interaction and with repetitive behavior, interests, and activities. And so the diagnosis of ASD now encompasses previously known diagnoses of autistic disorder, Asperger's disorder, childhood disintegrative disorder, and pervasive developmental disorder. And so they've all been combined into one. And what do we mean? What is a diagnosis based on? What do we mean when we say difficulties with social communication? Because a lot of people experience these symptoms but don't actually get diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, right? So it's difficulties in social communication can involve rarely using language to communicate with others or not speaking at all. rarely using or understanding gestures like pointing or waving, and using limited facial expressions to communicate. There's a lack of interest or having difficulties in making friends, and there's a lack of eye contact and a blunted affect. And so because individuals living with ASD don't process social cues the same way that a neurotypical person would, social cues are often the stimulus for a lot of emotions that we experience. And so an inability or deficit in this processing of social cues leads to a flattened affective expression. But under certain other conditions, like when experiencing a change in their environment or a change to routine, emotional reactions can be quite intense. And so ASD isn't a disorder that involves an emotional deficit, but it involves a social processing deficit. So there's a difference there, because people with ASD can experience emotions, they're just not as good as expressing them. Under the domain of restricted, repetitive, and sensory behavior or interests, these can involve behaviors like lining up toys in a particular way over and over again, speaking in a repetitive way, having very narrow or intense interests, needing things to always happen in the same way, and again, experiencing difficulties with changes to schedule or with changing from one activity to another. So there's a difficulty in making that sort of transition. And there are signs of heightened sensory sensitivity. So this is a little bit like what I talked about last week with ADHD and sensory overload. Children and people living with ASD become distressed by everyday sounds like hand dryers. They don't like the feel of certain textures like clothing labels. And many children will often have food-related issues because of sensitivities they have from an oral standpoint. So they don't like certain textures or smells or tastes of certain foods. And so all of these sensitivities can lead children living with ASD to recoil from situations or develop an intolerance for being in certain places and environments because they're really stressful and overwhelming. And aside from those two sort of criteria, one other test that's administered is called the Reading the Mind and the Eyes test. And this is where participants look at pictures of people's eyes. It's like a super zoomed in cropped photo of a face, but it's just the eyes visible. And you're asked to try and guess a person's emotions out of four options. And so this test is often administered and used to diagnose autism spectrum disorder because people with ASD don't often focus on the eyes when talking to someone else. They actually tend to focus on the mouth. And so, the eyes are the most expressive part of, they're a really great form of nonverbal communication. They give you a lot of emotional cues that pick up, that allow you to pick up on something that the other person is feeling. Whereas the mouth is less expressive. It gives you less information that you can work with. And so, people living with autism spectrum disorder, again, this is they have a deficit in social processing. They don't look at the eyes, which are very important cues of emotional information. And so they are unable to pick up on some really important cues that allow them to respond to emotions in other people or simply just be able to notice them. And so that's one of the most important things to remember, is that people living with ASD don't lack emotions. They don't feel less or, are unable to feel at all. It's just that they still feel the emotions and they still process them. It's just they're unable to express them in the same way that we are used to. So, my schedule's all messed up because the timing's off, but let's listen to Have You Ever Seen the Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the different levels of symptom severity in ASD and implicit bias. So let's hope this works. All right, so ASD is a single condition with different levels of symptom severity, hence it being a spectrum disorder. And so no one person will have the same experience living with ASD as another. Again, I'm sure we can see a pattern emerging with each segment I do, but one of the most important things I can strive to do here is break down stereotypes that are perpetuated through our language, our media, and our peers. And so living with autism spectrum disorder, along with any other mental illness, comes with a lot of stigma, right? And we all have implicit biases simply because of the culture we live in and the things that we consume, like we consume with our soul, you know? And so implicit biases are mental shortcuts that hold judgments that we might not explicitly agree with. And so this arises from our ordinary mental functioning. Having implicit bias doesn't mean that we are necessarily prejudiced, racist, or bad people. It simply means that we are partly a product of the society we live in. Right? So things like education, the media, news, and the conversations we have all cause us to form associations that can lead to bias. So for example, if someone says peanut butter, what do you think? Jelly or peanut butter and jam, right? Or if someone says Tom, what do you think? Jerry, Tom and Jerry, or like Tom Cat. And so these two things have been paired together repeatedly, just like around us, and that causes us to automatically think of one when the other is presented because they've been associated together. And one of my profs last semester does research on implicit associations and implicit bias, and he works a lot with the implicit association test, or the IAT. And so in a research context, when we talk about implicit bias, we talk about it in terms of measures that try to quickly tap into your associations between how you compare certain attributes with certain social groups. And so it's more of a measurement approach of how we can assess the strength of associations. That's what the IAT measures, the strength of the associations that you have between things. And they do that using your reaction time. So how long, how fast can you sort things into different categories, right? Like when you think of Tom, you automatically think of Jerry. So it's easy for you to pair them together. In the wider dialogue, or sort of like, in layman's language, when people talk about the concept of implicit bias, they often mean actually unintended discrimination, which is behavior that conflicts with your conscious intentions, but something's still leaking into your behavior. And sometimes our automatic associations, our implicit bias, which is often driven by society stereotypes, can trump our own explicit values. But in a research context, implicit bias is just the associations that you have, the strength of your associations, kind of. So we have to make a distinction first between explicit and implicit prejudice or bias. Explicit prejudice is deliberate and slow and or controllable, whereas implicit prejudice or bias is automatic and fast, and it's more difficult to control. Like when I say Tom or when I say peanut butter, your brain just automatically brings up that other concept of jam or jelly, right? You can't really control you stopping thinking about that. So that's sort of what implicit bias is as well. So the IAT is not a lie detector test. It's not trying to like dig down and discover your true self, or trying to find out who's lying when they say they don't have any racial preference or gender preference or things like that. The goal of the IAT is to identify if there's other things going on in people's minds that they aren't consciously aware of, and that the IAT taps into that. And so there are many different types of IATs that measure our automatic preference for many things. Like there's an age IAT, a race IAT, a gender science IAT, religion IAT, disability IAT, etc. And so to help you understand how this test works, I'm going to explain how the race IAT is set up. So basically, it's a categorization task that you do on the computer. You're asked to pair certain concepts together. And so there's two categories. And they'll either appear, one category will appear on the left side of your screen and the other category will appear on the right side of your screen. And each category has two different items that you can sort into it. And so let's say on the computer, you're asked to press the left arrow key to sort things into the left category and the right arrow key to sort things into the right category. And so you're presented with a bunch of faces and words in the center of your screen, and you have to sort those words either, and those words and faces, either to the left or to the right category. So let's say in the first round, the left category, you have to sort black people, black faces, and bad words into the left category. And in the right category, you want to sort white faces and good words into that category. And so when you're presented with a series of stimuli, when you see a bunch of faces and a bunch of words, you have to sort them either into the left or the right. In another round, After you do that a bunch of times, your reaction time will be assessed and your accuracy will be assessed. And then in another round, the categories will swap. So that on the left side now, you want to sort black faces and good words on the left side. Whereas on the right side, you want to sort white faces and bad words. And then you do the task again, your reaction time is measured and your accuracy is measured. And the findings are really interesting. So you can do these tests online. You can go to the website called Project Implicit. Over 3 million people have taken it since 2021. So there's a large amount of data that researchers like my professor can work with and use to extrapolate findings. So what they find is that with white participants, most people have an automatic racial preference towards white people. They show a pro-white implicit bias. What does that actually mean, though? It means that when they did the IAT, the test, they were faster and more accurate when sorting when the categories were the left side was black people and bad words, and the other category was white people and good words. And they were slower at sorting stimuli into the categories when the categories were black people and good words and white people and bad words. And so when a black face appeared on the screen, white participants were more easily able to sort it into the category of black people and bad words than they were when a black face appeared and they had to sort it into the category of black people and good words. And why is this happening? Well, because in their heads, they automatically pair black people and bad words together because things that associate with each other, they share this concept of quote-unquote badness. They both have a negative valence to them. And so you have to think less because then you can combine the two items in that category into one. And so when you see a black face or when you see a bad word pop up in the center of your screen, it's really easy for you to automatically think, okay, those both are bad, so I'm going to sort them in the left. And it's so much easier because it's just meshed into one category because you have the same negative association with black people and with bad words. However, when it was flipped and the category was now black people and good words and white people and bad words, when white participants were presented with a black face, the instinct is being pulled in different directions now because you're pairing things with a different valence to them. So black people, implicitly, at least in people's implicit minds, they have the valence of badness, whereas good words obviously have the valence of goodness. And so when a black face pops up in the center of your screen, you have to think a little bit more about what category this face actually belongs to, because one category is black faces and good words now. So that association doesn't come as quickly to you in your head. And so it takes you some more time to press the actual corresponding left or right arrow. And because you're asked to do this task as fast as possible, you're also more likely to make mistakes in this time. So I hope my explanation of the test makes sense. If it doesn't, I will also post the link to the website Project Implicit, where you can take some IATs for yourself, see how it works, and see the results that you get. And so for black participants, the most common score when they did this IAT test was there was no preference for either white or black people. And so when you score on the IAT, on the race IAT, you can either score as no preference or a pro-white automatic racial preference or a pro-black automatic racial preference. And what's interesting about these findings is that you would maybe expect, because white participants showed a pro-white automatic racial preference, perhaps black participants would either also show a pro-white automatic racial preference or black participants would show an automatic pro-black racial preference, right? However, the most common score was no preference. So why did we see this finding? And where do actually our implicit biases come from? Well, over time, our mind has automatically built up certain types of associations, right? Like the same way that we build up associations about between peanut butter and jelly, we build up associations about all the different concepts and things that we encounter in our environment. And these associations, this reflects, one, our personal identity. And so this is who we are, what our experiences have been. And typically, our experiences with our personal identity are generally positive, right? We, like, spend a lot of time with ourselves. We enjoy being ourselves. And so this is a source of positivity and a source of sort of, like, in-group bias. Because you feel good when the group that you belong to does good. And one of the groups that you can belong to, one of the social groups that you can belong to is a racial group. And this, there's a bunch of different social identities you can have, but this is just one. And these associations come from, so they come from one, our personal identity, but also they come from two, our understanding of social hierarchy. And so we understand what groups in society are of higher status. And this is just because of messages relayed from our cultural environment. And we internalize those. And this pattern doesn't happen just for race. For example, there's a gender bias on the gender science IAT such that we're more likely to more accurately and quickly pair men in science together than we do women in science, right? And so when we think about the findings that white people have a pro-white implicit bias, this is because, one, of their personal identity, right? They are white, and so their experiences being themselves are generally positive, not just because they're white, but just because every single individual generally has positive experiences with their personal identity. And so that's a source of pride, a source of positivity, and a source of like, yes, I prefer that because that's who I am. But also our understanding of social hierarchy plays into that, because in society, you know, through education, through the media, through the things that we are socialized by, we learn, and through like our institutions, our policies, we learn that white people are often more valued in society than people from other races. And that's just being a product of our cultural environment, right? We pick up on these cues and we internalize them because we live in them. And so those two forces can work together to create this pro-white implicit bias that we see. However, for Black participants, they're sort of contrasting forces, whereas their understanding of social hierarchy is the same as ours, right? They know that what groups in society are of higher status, just given like the history and what's the ongoing, you know, we see systemic racism, we see racism in policies, we see them in organizations, and we also see them on an individual level. And so their culture, our cultural environment makes it known that white people are more valued. And obviously that's changing, but that has been sort of the general buildup of years and years of socialization. However, their own personal identity gives them positive experiences, right? That makes them have more positive experiences with their own identity. And so these two forces, this pro-Black force from their personal identity and their understanding of social hierarchy, may be working against each other. And that could explain why for most Black participants, the most common score on the IAT was that there was no automatic implicit racial preference. But what does this actually mean? Because the IAT is not telling you, like, your score on the IAT doesn't mean that you have, you know, racist thoughts, racist beliefs, you act in a discriminatory way, or you engage in stereotyping. It says that doesn't translate into your actual behavior all the time. And so what the results of the IAT simply mean to tell you is that you are a product of your environment. You are not just a product of yourself. Your influences on your environment are there, and they are like, there's a signature of them in the way that you think, in the way that you associate things. And that's totally okay, because that's just at an implicit level. It doesn't mean that explicitly you agree with those. It's just something that it's just a product of our social environment partly. And so when do the IAT scores actually influence behavior? How can we actually tell when they will influence our behavior? Because there are occasions in certain kinds of situations where the IAT, our implicit biases that we have, these automatic preferences, can influence our behavior. And so we're going to listen to a song, and then we are going to talk about that. This is Too Few Tattoos by Pretty Jane and the Magazines.
Smoke in my eyes. Is she just a trick of the light? Played by these summer nights. Strawberry moon in red and white. Am I out of my mind? Am I out of my mind? 'Cause I've been up looking for someone to lose. Not too much time and not too tattoos and I love her. When I'm not awake, fix me a sunrise and I'm sleeping late. Oh, I love her.
for someone to lose. Not too much time and not too few tattoos. And I love her when I'm not away. Fix me a sunrise and I'll sleep in late. Oh, I love her when I'm not away. Warm the bed and I'll wait for someone to love.
Okay, so when do our implicit biases influence our behavior? Our implicit biases can influence our behavior, can influence our behavior when we are stressed, when we are tired, when we are drunk, when we are lazy, or on a deadline. So basically, whenever we are lacking cognitive resources, perhaps we are more reliant on these implicit associations. And this sort of makes sense. So let me give you an example. Studies have found that the rate of hand washing among nurses over the course of a 13-hour shift decreases as the time passes. So as the time since the start of the shift has increased, the rate of hand washing decreases. And this change in behavior is because people are tired. You know, working 13-hour shifts, especially as a nurse, is really, really exhausting. And so when people are tired, we look for shortcuts or the fastest way to do something. And so this might lead someone to be more reliant on their automatic implicit biases, because what is a stereotype but a shortcut, right? It's a means by which you don't have to think about people as individuals, but rather you rely on some sort of group identity that they belong to make predictions about them, right? So you draw on the use of stereotypes a lot more, because stereotypes are basically mental shortcuts. They're very broad generalizations, and they sort of allow us to forget about thinking about the unique properties of every single individual. And so that's one time that implicit biases can influence our behavior. And they're also more likely to influence our behavior when the criteria for making a decision is unclear, and when the information you are provided with is ambiguous or incomplete. And so it's important, for example, if you're trying to hire someone for a job and you're choosing between two different people, when the criteria for making a decision are unclear, you're not really sure what makes one of them a better candidate than the other person, or when you don't know the full story about either of them, you're more likely to draw on your implicit biases, because it takes a lot of effort to, you know, like parse out the two separate lives of these two individuals and who they are, and you are more likely to rely on stereotypes. And so one thing that's really important to do is to set out your criteria for making a decision before you make the decision. You need to know exactly what you want to know, what your requirements are, so that you're less likely to be influenced by your implicit biases, right? They're also more likely to influence your behavior when policies and systems allow for it. Because, you know, we are a lot of policies and systems are authority to us, right? And so what we see as the cultural norm is what we also will practice in our daily life. And so because of this moderate correlation that our scores on the IAT can have with behavior, researchers have tried to find ways to reduce our implicit bias in order to reduce discrimination. And so Calvin Lai, actually a researcher, performed a study which was basically a research contest, and he tested out a bunch of interventions that people had for changing someone's performance on the race IAT. And he looked at four different studies. He did 18 different interventions, which were 5 minutes or less, and then did an IAT assessment before and after the intervention to see if people's implicit biases have changed. And so what he found was that using counter stereotypes and strategies to control bias are the most effective for reducing implicit prejudice, at least in the short term. And so counter stereotypes are showing people that seem to go against the stereotype that they have. So for example, for the race IAT, you would show people a disliked white person in an admired black person, or ask someone to imagine that they're walking home late at night and imagine that they're being attacked by a white person who's trying to take your car and hurt you, and then a black person will appear and fight off the white person and save you. That's like an example scenario that they would give. And they found that these interventions were most effective if they were emotionally arousing, if they were self and if they were self-relevant. But as we remember, like, these interventions were only 5 minutes long, and they checked your score on the IAT right after these interventions were given. So how actually durable are these effects for changing your implicit biases? Because they're so automatic and fast, right? So in a follow-up study that Calvin Lai did, he wanted to see how long these interventions would last. And so he did a follow-up session 5 minutes after the intervention was given and 24 hours after. And so after 5 minutes, he found that we see the same effect after the intervention. There is a reduction in your implicit bias. There is a reduction in your IAT score. However, 24 hours later, everything that seemed to have worked in the short term it went away, right? There was no difference in the IAT scores. There was a total return to baseline. And so the effect of the intervention did not even last enough for 1 day. And so how should we think about our implicit biases? Because we know that they're there, and we know that they're malleable in the short term, but they're pretty stable in the long term. You know, it's really hard to change, because it's really the idea that you can wipe all of your... So basically your performance on the IAT, again, also reflects the accumulation of years and years of exposure to certain types of thinking, to biased media, to cultural stereotypes, and things like that. And so we internalize those. And the idea that you can sort of wipe all of that out in 5 minutes with a simple intervention is very unrealistic and overly optimistic. And so there are things that we can do to change your performance on the IAT in the short term. But, like, again, researchers aren't really interested in changing people's IAT score for the sake of changing their IAT score, right? They're more interested in things like discriminatory behavior and IAT scores. And so when looking at studies that included a manipulation to something like the IAT and a measure of discriminatory behavior, they found that in the aggregate, these interventions or procedures actually did not produce significant indirect effects. And so there is not... they didn't find the result that was consistent with a causal relationship between a change in implicit measures and a change in behavior. And so what this means is that changing your implicit bias or your performance on the IAT task was not going to change your behavior. There's no evidence that changing people's IAT score is a good way to change any discriminatory behavior. And so an alternative approach that has been discussed is to treat discrimination as a design problem rather than an attitude or belief problem, right? So perhaps the best way we can work to reduce discrimination is to limit the opportunity that these prejudices can operate rather than trying to change the prejudice themselves. Because as we know, we can implicitly have these biases, but we can explicitly believe in egalitarian values and refute and deny these cultural stereotypes and messages and know, like, and have different explicit beliefs. So ways that we can limit the opportunity that prejudices operate is make sure that when you are tired, lazy, on a deadline, or drunk, or stressed, you have to make sure that you're not coming into a situation or an interaction with these implicit biases. You have to be conscious of, you know, your actions and what you choose to consume. And again, like in a hiring situation, you have to set out the criteria that you're looking for first before you even see the candidates that appear to you, so that you can limit the biases that may play into your decision-making. Because if you already know what you're looking for, if someone meets those criteria, it doesn't matter what their group identity is, you will do them based off of merit. Right. So anyways, this whole talk about implicit biases is all to say that we have to actively change our conscious representation of individuals living with autism spectrum disorder, along with other neurodevelopmental disorders and other mental illnesses, because our implicit biases are very automatic. They come really fast and they're very hard to control, and we can't just let them affect our behavior. And that means being, again, I'm being a broken record here, but it means we have to be a conscious consumer of media and to always check ourselves and check our biases, question our beliefs, and question where they came from. You know, why am I actually thinking this way? Why do I think of this person in this way? Where is that actually coming from? And is that accurate? Right? For example, Greta Thunberg is on the autism spectrum. She was diagnosed with Asperger's disorder, but that has been brought under the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder now. And she's doing amazing advocate work for climate change awareness and for policy change. And does her diagnosis take away from her accomplishments? No. Has it stopped her from making a positive social impact in the world? No. And so when we question, when we have these automatic associations between someone living with ASD or someone living with mental illness, we have often negative associations with them. However, we have to realize that they're not barriers, or like they don't speak to our ability to do things. Yes. So check your implicit biases. We all have them, and that's totally okay. It just means that we're partly a product of the society that we live in and the cultural messaging that we've internalized. But that doesn't mean anything about who we are as a person or what we explicitly believe. So, I'm going to wrap up today with talking about what it means to be on the autism spectrum. So talking a little bit about the different levels of, being diagnosed with ASD, and we'll see if we have time for anything else after that. But for now, we're going to listen to In Love by Lady Ray. So what does it mean to be on the autism spectrum? Higher functioning levels of autism spectrum disorder, which used to be called Asperger's disorder, are people who have more of the stereotypical behaviors. They have repetitive interests, but their communication skills are there. And so Asperger's is now known as being a high-functioning person with autism spectrum disorder, and so Greta Thunberg is here on level one. A high-functioning person, sometimes you don't even require diagnosis or support in school or work. And so you're able to, go about your daily life without experiencing any significant disruptions or deficits in your functioning. Whereas a low functioning person on the spectrum would have intense behaviors that are impeding with their ability to be independent in their life. They have very little or no communication skills, and they're unable to interact with other people in their environment without additional support. And so level 3 ASD is typically diagnosed very early in life. But it's always important to remember that autism is a dimension and there's a normal distribution. And so to some extent, all or many of us can be characterized on this distribution. We will fall somewhere on this normal distribution. And so there are a lot of behaviors that people living with ASD display that we also display as neurotypical people as well in our everyday lives. It's just the amount of disruption that it causes to your functioning. And so I think I want to spend this time talking about some cool studies. So a study conducted by Simon Baron Cohen wanted to see if autistic traits were an independent personality dimension. And so in personality research, there's something called the Big Five traits that are part of your personality. And everyone falls on some sort of level of these traits. And so they wanted to see if autism would come out as a sixth personality factor independent and separate of these Big Five traits. And so what these researchers found is that being higher on ASD is more strongly related to extroversion. So there's association between scoring more on the introverted or detached end of the extroversion scale and being higher on ASD, which makes sense because they have deficits in social communication. ASD is also associated with neuroticism, which is particularly true for high-functioning autistic individuals. And so another study has found that there are fewer women who have autism in general, but women are more likely to have difficulties when they're around adolescent age, like 13, 14, because navigating the social hierarchies and connections of the teenage years is more complicated for girls than boys because girls are more social creatures. And so females with ASD will experience a lot more difficulty in adolescence than males because of that importance of social connection. And the factor analysis that these researchers did found that the autism questionnaire actually came out as a separate factor, and they argue that it's distinct from the Big Five. However, there has to be replications of this data because they didn't use individual items from the two scales. They used subscales instead. And so the most one really interesting finding is that university students who score higher on the autism spectrum might report higher levels of depression and self-consciousness. However, when you break down extroversion, so extroversion has two facets, and the two facets are depression and self-consciousness, but also, and then there's another facet of gregariousness, which is just wanting to be with people. And so when you break down extroversion, university students who score higher on the autism spectrum actually scored lowest on gregariousness, which is just wanting to be with people. So they don't really want to be around people as much as other people do, which makes sense, as we talked about like at the very beginning, where deficits in social communication and interaction play a part, right? So you don't really want, you have difficulty making friends, or you have not really a big interest in making friends. You'd rather prefer to be alone. And autism has the strongest associations with the extroversion / introversion portion of the Big Five traits. And so it has the strongest associations with that and with emotional stability. And so when an individual has autism spectrum disorder, they are more likely to score lower on the Big Five traits. But if they do score higher, that also has some predictive value as well. And so there's obviously a lot of heterogeneity among individuals who live with autism spectrum disorder, especially those that are more higher functioning. And so people who would previously have been diagnosed with what is now autism spectrum disorder, but was previously called Asperger's, they're higher on extroversion or higher on conscientiousness and lower on neuroticism. And so they have a more adaptive Big Five profile, which makes sense given that they are more higher functioning and their deficits don't interact with their functioning on a day-to-day life as much. And so there's just so much individuality and uniqueness that comes with a diagnosis of ASD that it's really unfair to be drawing on our stereotypes when thinking about people living with ASD. And again, broken record, be a conscious consumer of your own thoughts. Question your thoughts and your beliefs and where they come from, and question what you see in the media, because what we see in the media, as we know, is never always accurate. And that's what I do. So I hope that has been insightful and helpful. Next month, I'm actually doing two segments. So I will be, because there's 5 weeks in August, I'm pretty sure. So I will be doing Voices of Montreal on the fourth Thursday of next month and the last Thursday. So the last two Thursdays of next month, we will be having a segment. And I'm going to try and get more guests on here so that we can actually hear experiences from families, and from individuals living with certain kinds of mental illnesses or struggling with mental health, or individuals who have some advice to give. And so I will keep you guys updated on that. But that was Voices of Montreal Panacea with me, Michelle. And you are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you for joining me for some vulnerable conversations and fun tunes. And as always, some technical difficulties. And I will see you guys next month. Or not see you, but talk to you. Okay, cool. Bye. Bye. We'll be right back.
You be play it in the streets, make it flow up in the breeze. And anytime the reggae play, yo, we bring a stress relief, yo. We not promote no criminal nor no thief. Anytime touch please, if I get yo, we burn up all the beasts. So we tell them, say, play with some good reggae music, yeah. It's a reggae music, yeah. Cause we can afford to go lose it. It's a reggae music, it's a reggae music, yeah. Play with some good reggae. Just make it music, yeah. We can't afford to go lose it. Oh no, oh no. Hold on, the people them tired that the ism and the schism and the looting and the shooting with them gun lyrics. Hey, a man want hold a joy in a the dance with the woman, yeah. And just squeeze and breast. If the blind, the deaf, the dumb, them will love to have some fun. Feel the tremor in the bass when we are beat the get that jump. Oh, well, Lord, and all we got is love. Represent for reggae music, keep it flying like God. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Play with some good reggae music. Oh, yeah. It's a reggae music, yeah. Cause we can't afford to go lose it. It's a reggae music, yeah. Can play me some good reggae music, yeah. Can't just reggae music, yeah. Cause we can't afford to go lose it. Oh no, oh oh, I say, play me some good music, yeah.
Something that I wanna do.